The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Revolver News has a new bombshell which focuses not just on Ray Epps but on other instigators, seemingly FBI operatives who were involved in getting the breach of the Capitol going. I'll give you the details. Joe Manchin has turned out to be the iceberg that is sinking the USS Biden. Down goes the Build Back Better bill, and the left is like, Joe Manchin's got a lot of explaining to do to his constituents in West Virginia. No, he doesn't. I'll tell you why. I'm going to resolve the mystery of why people like Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, Lisa Murkowski, why do they behave the way they do? What's in it for them? I'll tell you what. And former combat veteran Corey Mills will join me. He's going to talk about the private operations to rescue Americans that the Biden administration has left stranded in Afghanistan. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
There is a new bombshell in Revolver News that picks up on a theme that was covered in an earlier story focusing on this guy named Ray Epps, who was prominently seen on video yelling for people to go into the Capitol on January 6th. Now, what makes all this really interesting is that Ray Epps has never been indicted. And yet, he is red-handed as an instigator, in fact, seemingly the primary instigator, directing people where to go and what to do. Now, this fact that they haven't gone after Ray Epps, even though he was originally on an FBI most wanted list, is strange. It's very odd. And by itself, it's just an anomaly. But what makes this new Revolver article so interesting is they broaden the argument, they broaden the evidence beyond Ray Epps, showing that there are other guys, very strikingly, who essentially enabled the Capitol breach. In fact, they took down barriers at the very logical point where the crowd would come from the Trump rally toward the Capitol, essentially saying, go in through here, this is the pathway in. And none of these guys, none of these key individuals have been indicted. Revolver News calls one guy scaffold commander. They have another guy methodically cutting down the fence, almost in a professional way. This is not some sort of activist who's shouting slogans. He doesn't have any Trump gear on. In fact, he's just got dark sunglasses on. And it's like he's there to do a job. So these guys, it appears, are doing the FBI's bidding. They are, it seems, inside men. Now, the FBI hasn't acknowledged this. And, of course, the left is like, there's no evidence the FBI was involved. Well, what do they mean by evidence? What they mean by evidence is that the FBI hasn't publicly admitted that they instigated January 6th. That's the only thing that, for the left, would constitute evidence. By contrast, people shouting, go in the Capitol, and other people cutting the fence, and a third guy standing on a booth tower basically directing people in, all these people unindicted. That's not evidence. Oh, nothing to see here, folks. That doesn't mean anything, Dinesh. So this is basically the state that we're in which evidence, real evidence, this is when you're trying to solve a mystery and you're pointing to facts on the scene, captured on video, and you're asking legitimate questions, you are interpreting empirical evidence, whether the left chooses to deny it or not. Now, I'll just give you a little glimpse of what's in the Revolver article. And I want to say that, you know, this is why it's so important for our side to do investigative reporting. And there's so few people who do it. There's an awful lot of sort of conservative intellectual punditry. But I found even in my own work, the most effective work is stuff like my movie on Obama, which shows you a side of Obama that you hadn't seen before. And it's like, look, see for yourself. Wow, we had no idea. Or even the history of the Democratic Party. That scholarly fact-finding, scholarly digging that shows that, listen, even after he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Lyndon Johnson was still a raging bigot. So it makes no sense. The left's argument that he somehow changed his mind makes absolutely no sense in the view of the facts produced right here. Now, in the Revolver article, they show they're taking on the left's narrative, which is that basically the breach of the Capitol got going when the Proud Boys got there. This is the kind of, call it the New York Times version of the story. But, says Revolver, that's impossible. The Proud Boys didn't get to the monument, to the Peace Monument, until 12:48 p.m., when the real breach occurred by Ray Epps and by the other guys around him, the guy on the tower, the so-called scaffold guy, when that occurred, the Proud Boys were still eating lunch and Trump was still speaking. So the timeline is really important here. The guys who enabled the breach were not the Proud Boys. They were a group of unidentified guys. Well, unidentified with the exception of Epps, who is identified. And none of these people have been indicted by the FBI. This is what's so telling. Revolver calls them the breach team. And what you do is you see them not just taking down any barricades, they're taking down the exact barricades that make it possible for the crowd. Remember, a crowd is sort of like an animal without a kind of guiding intelligence. It's moving kind of aimlessly toward the Capitol. Now, had there been a breach in some side location, the crowd would never have found it. But the breach here was strategically calculated for the crowd to go in. It's almost as if, and this is the phrase from Revolver, this might have been, quote, the largest legal booby trap in American history. Now, you know, the left might say, well, Dinesh, this is are you trying to peddle some sort of a conspiracy theory? Are you trying to sort of imply some sort of an inside job? First of all, the idea of a conspiracy is the left's own theory. I mean, the left says that January 6th was an inside job. So it's not as if the left claims that January 6th was a spontaneous action by a crowd, and the right is saying it's an inside job. Both sides are saying it's an inside job, and of course the disagreement is about who did the inside job. So from the left's point of view, this is sort of the Liz Cheney version of the story, which is the Pelosi version. It was Trump and the Trumpsters around him, and the January 6th commission is with, like, relentless, indefatigable sleuthing. You know, let's get Mark Meadows' text. Let's see if he was communicating with Louis Gohmert. So they're following their inside job theory. But what they're not doing, and I don't believe they're going to start doing, because this is too explosive for them to even touch. What about the inside job theory from the other side, which is that the FBI is the one? This is a question. It's not an answer. But I think the significance of the Revolver expose, and this is what good journalism does, is it raises powerful questions and provides supporting evidence that makes the questions legitimate and demands public answers. Now, concluding this article, Darren Beatty, the editor of Revolver, whom we've had on the podcast, realizes that he needs a smoking gun. He realizes that no matter how detailed your article, and this is a beautifully detailed article, I mean, it gives you almost a minute-by-minute, frame-by-frame, with video evidence for you to look for yourself and see. But at the end, Darren, I think, knows that he needs just one thing more. And what is it that he needs? Well, I'm just going to read his tweet. He says, as wrong as it is to work as an entrapment agent for the feds, many of these people are manipulated by their higher-ups. They're not told the full story, and all it takes now is one brave informant with a conscience and BALLS to take the story to the next level. Expose your handler. So yes, what we need, and we're Republicans, if they had any sense, would be looking for this, trying to bring out one of the FBI agents who was actively involved in instigating January 6th to go, you know what, this stinks. This is not the way a government should treat its own citizens. This was a trap set by the government, and I'm going to step forward, and I'm going to spill the beans, and I'm going to go before Congress, and I'm going to go before the American people, and I'm going to tell them what we all want to know, what really happened. Mike Lindell is just one amazing guy. I mean, we just learned he's going to be donating 10,000 pillows to families devastated by the tornadoes in Kentucky. This guy just has a huge heart. These pillows will arrive on Christmas Eve. Now, Mike couldn't do any of this without his loyal customers, people like me and people like you. You can get the lowest price in the history of MyPillow for the classic standard MyPillow. Now, it's normally $69.98. You can get it for $19.98 with promo code Dinesh. These wonderful pillows, they won't go flat. You can wash and dry them as often as you want. They maintain their shape. They're made in the USA. By the way, queen-size pillows, regularly $79.98, now $24.98. King-size, regularly $89.98, now $29.98. And MyPillow isn't just pillows. Mike's got over 150 products, everything from sleepwear to robes to my new beds. So go to MyPillow.com or call 800-876-0227. Use promo code Dinesh to take advantage of Mike's special offers on the pillows and on all the other products. The number again, 800-876-0227, or go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. Joe Manchin has sunk the big Biden better build back boondoggle. This ridiculous titanic of a legislation, this $3.5 trillion bill that they had obligingly scaled back to the $1.75 trillion range, essentially to woo Joe Manchin. Well, the good news is he's not going for it. And what I love is not only his no, but the way he did it, he goes on Fox News, and apparently, without even telling Biden, he goes, kind of, I'm a hard no. I'm not going to do it. I can't vote for it, to quote Joe Manchin. And apparently, the Biden people are absolutely furious. They're like, we had him over. We had him over to the White House. We had him sitting in the very chair. We have foreign dignitaries. We even had him to Joe Biden's house in Delaware. So apparently they thought that all this kind of courting of Joe Manchin would cause him to buckle in the way that their normal Democratic sleazeballs do buckle. They basically ask, what's in it for me? What are some goodies you can offer me? And they sell out. But with Joe Biden, he's not doing it. And I love his quote. My Democratic colleagues in Washington are determined to dramatically reshape our society in a way that leaves our country even more vulnerable to the threats we face. Wow. So what are those threats? Well, he's talking about inflation. He's talking about creating chronic government dependency, which is to the long-term competitive disadvantage of the United States. So there are all kinds of good things that have come out of this. And well, I guess on a very small note, one good thing is, I mean, I was getting a little tired of that little indefatigable Indian fellow, M.K. Manu Raju, who keeps running after Biden every way. Are you going to vote for it? Are you going to vote for it? Are you going to vote for it? Vote for it? You know, and Manchin would be like, I said Biden, but I meant Manchin. Manchin would be like kind of putting him off. I guess now Raju can go chase after someone else because Manchin has declared his position. ABC News headline, a single senator is about to seriously set back an entire presidential agenda. A single senator. Manchin's doing it on his own. No mention of the 50 Republicans that are holding firm. And by the way, here we have to give a little credit to Mitch McConnell. I've been critical of McConnell on the podcast, and for good reason, I think. But there's another side. McConnell has done an amazing job, a great job. Think of how hard it is to hold the entire 50 Republicans, including people like Romney and Murkowski and Susan Collins. And essentially, it's 50 no's. And it's the 50 no's plus Manchin that creates the 51 vote majority in the Senate. So the Democrats are acting like Manchin is thwarting a majority. But the simple fact of the matter is that the defeat of this legislation is a triumph of democracy, of majority vote. Why? Because a bipartisan coalition of 51 senators has shut down a minority scheme by a scheme run by the minority in the Senate to ram this through with the help of media pressure. And so, fortunately, democracy prevailed and the majority got its way. Now, I'm laughing at Bernie Sanders because he goes on, I think it was CNN, and he goes, Joe Manchin's got a lot of explaining to do to the citizens of West Virginia. And I'm thinking, Wait, are you telling me that this left-wing socialist from Massachusetts, this guy who's basically never worked a day in his life, this guy who's gone from being a private leech to being a public leech, this guy understands West Virginia better than Joe Manchin, a state, by the way, that Trump carried by almost 70%, by almost a margin of over 30 points? There have been polls in West Virginia, and West Virginians overwhelmingly oppose this Better Build Back. So it's actually no mystery. You don't have to read the tea leaf. Why would Joe Manchin do this? Unless you think that Joe Manchin is some kind of a serf of Pelosi, Schumer, and Biden himself, Joe Manchin is doing what his constituents want. He's actually representing, as, by the way, is Sinema, whose vote was never assured for this legislation. The good news is that I think this bill is dead in the water. Now, Biden isn't admitting this. He's like, well, we're going to have to get back to it early in the new year. But there's a lot of bad blood that is now brewing between the White House and Manchin. And part of it is the stinging statements that the White House is putting out, basically implying that Manchin has, quote, done a breach of his commitments to the president. So Manchin's a liar. Manchin gave assurances and he's now backing out of it. And then here's the White House. Maybe Senator Manchin can explain to the millions of children who've been lifted out of poverty, in part due to the child care credit, why he wants to end a program that is helping achieve this milestone. We cannot. So Manchin doesn't care about children, but apparently Biden, Psaki, and the White House does. So apparently Manchin is really annoyed at these people. And I'm delighted at his annoyance. And I'm also delighted at the discombobulation of the left. I think it's time for Manchin to really think about kind of, you know, just jumping over the tennis net, going over to the other side. Because, he would be a kind of a rhino, I admit. He would be a rhino in the Republican camp. But this is a time, and it may be the only time, where we can say a good word for the rhino. You probably heard the breaking news. U.S. consumer prices soared 6.8% compared to last year. This is the biggest increase since 1982. You need to protect your investments from this out-of-control administration, or you're going to have, well, not a whole lot left for the future. The best thing to do is to save and to take care of your savings. Now, you're making a mistake if you aren't diversifying your savings. Hold gold in a tax-sheltered account, or just hold gold in your home, in your safe. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. It's the only company I trust and recommend. And when you buy gold from Birch Gold by December 23rd, they'll send you free gold for every $10,000 you purchase. First time they've ever offered free gold. Now, with thousands of satisfied customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, you can trust Birch Gold to protect your savings. So go ahead, just a few days left, text Dinesh to 989898 to claim eligibility for their free gold with purchase offer by December 23rd. Again, text Dinesh to 989898 and protect your savings today. How do you solve a problem like Liz Cheney? I guess I'm using the line from The Sound of Music. How do you solve a problem like Liz Cheney? Well, one way you solve a problem like Liz Cheney is you try to understand what is motivating Liz Cheney. And this is not actually obvious. I mean, think about it. Here's Liz Cheney, who is kind of a pretty solid Republican from a solidly Republican state, Wyoming. And now she has become a kind of systematic basher of Trump and the MAGA, the Make America Great Again movement. And she takes every opportunity she can to sort of turn the knife. She takes great delight in doing what she does. She appears now to be a pawn of Pelosi. And let's think about the vicious response of Pelosi and the Democrats to her own family, to her own father. They treated him like he was a monster, a warmonger. So why would Liz Cheney be acting in this way? Yes, part of it is a hatred of Trump, but the broader question is, what's in it for her? What is she? She doesn't seem to have much of a political future in Wyoming. I think she is basically, you know, not dead man, but dead woman walking, politically speaking, in her own district. Lots of people are gearing up to run. Trump has already made an endorsement. Liz Cheney may as well throw in the towel. So where is Liz Cheney headed? And it's a bigger question than Liz Cheney. You can ask the same question about, you know, Mitt Romney, the same question about Murkowski. Where are they? What are they sort of, What are they going for? Now, by the way, we should distinguish this question from what is, say, Susan Collins going for. Because what Susan Collins is doing is she's actually representing her constituents. She's representing a middle to somewhat blue state, Maine. And she is running to the middle and is articulating positions in the middle because that's where her constituents are. But that's not true of Romney, and that's not true of Liz Cheney. So what is the method, if there is one, to their madness? I want to argue that really what they're up to is a form of long-term careerism. Now, here's what I mean by this. If you are a conservative in the Congress, and you sell out, there are huge rewards waiting for you. You have a smooth path after Congress. So I think with Liz Cheney, she's not thinking about how do I get reelected. She knows that's gone. And she, you know, we'll sometimes say, well, she's angling for a position on MSNBC or CNN. But there are much better, much more lucrative, much more culturally, positions with far more cultural cachet than that. She could go on various corporate boards because suddenly she's now the voice of conscience. Suddenly she has become the person who can be counted on to be, as a Republican, I'm going to criticize Republicans. There's a market for that in liberal culture, including in woke corporations. Look at, for example, a guy like Paul Ryan, who serves on corporate boards, is in fact on the board at Fox News. Look what a lucrative career that guy's had after an extremely ineffective, virtually useless career in the House. Liz Cheney could go for university president. That's the kind of job that I can see her getting, not just in Wyoming, but somewhere around the country. Foundation president. There are foundations that have huge amounts of money. Liberal foundations or even moderate foundations that go, well, you know what, Liz Cheney's kind of in the middle, but, you know, she's a Republican, but she's not a Trumpster. And so there are lucrative positions in the foundation world waiting for her. There are lucrative book deals waiting for her. All kinds of publishers. Liz Cheney, talk about your journey, how you learned that the conservative values that you were raised in are have now been usurped by a bunch of madmen, and how you're the sole voice of sanity speaking for moderate conservative values, which basically incline you today toward the Democratic Party. Liz Cheney, I wouldn't be surprised, will turning up at Davos and the kind of international circuit, getting all kinds of prizes and awards. If you want to see how it's profitable to turn against the right, just contrast a guy like Paul Ryan with a guy like Newt Gingrich. This is a very good comparison because both of them were Speaker of the House. So what's Newt Gingrich doing today? Well, not a whole lot. He's a commentator. He maintains a public presence. I spot him on Fox News every now and then. His wife is a U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, or was under Trump. And but Gingrich, by and large, is essentially kind of on his own. But look, by contrast, at Paul Ryan. Now, Paul Ryan wasn't as close to as influential as Gingrich. He's not as well recognized as Gingrich. Gingrich has a much bigger public name. But Paul Ryan's post-congressional career opportunities are much greater than Gingrich's. He can serve on corporate boards. He could be up for university president. There are all kinds of ways in which Paul Ryan can rake it in that are not available to Gingrich. And why? Because Gingrich stuck true to his beliefs, and Paul Ryan, in a sense, made the right signals to the left that he was essentially available, as is Liz Cheney, to do their bidding. How about a new year, 2022, without aches and pains? You go, what? Well, aches and pains come to us all eventually, whether from the normal wear and tear of time or from injury. But you know what? There's a solution to all this. It's called Relief Factor. Now, Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation, and it's inflammation that's the source of aches and pains. The vast majority of people who try Relief Factor, they're hooked on it. They say, order more. Why? Because it works for them. Debbie is a true believer in Relief Factor. It's been a game changer for relieving the pain caused by her frozen shoulder, and she knows if she doesn't take it, the pain's going to come right back. So Debbie says, well, I'm never going to be without Relief Factor again, because being able to lift her arm and exercise exercise. This is super important to her. Relief Factor is the tool she needs. She's glad she's got it. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. You'll see. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That number again, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. Feel the difference. You know, guys, the Biden administration has left Americans and American allies in Afghanistan, and we don't hear a whole lot these days about it in the media. So I'm really happy to invite Corey Mills to come on the podcast. Corey Mills is a candidate for Congress, Florida District 7. He's a decorated war veteran, combat veteran. He served in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's also been a Trump appointee to the Pentagon as a Department of Defense advisor. And he's been involved in something very interesting, namely rescue efforts, private rescue efforts of Americans in Afghanistan. Corey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me. Let me start by just asking you, I mean, isn't it strange if we think back to the hostage crisis? Now, this is going back to the late 1970s, early 80s. But I just remember when I first came to America, you know, Walter Cronkite on the media, you know, it's the 49th day, it's the 50th day of the hostage crisis. They kept it front and center in the American eye, you might say. But with Afghanistan, apparently to cover for Biden, it's like, let's move on. We don't want to hear a word about it. Do you notice this as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you notice anything with the Biden administration, you see where their media cycles move past all the negativity very abruptly. You see this where during the Trump administration, they were counting every individual COVID death. But now we've got over 100,000 opioid overdoses and yet nothing's being tracked. You've got hundreds of days where Americans have been left behind who are being hunted by ISIS and Haqqani and Taliban. But it just continues to speed on past, try and look at Build Back Better or another thing that highlights. So again, journalism for the most part has changed so much that it's just not what it was during the Walter Cronkite days.
Now, hey, Corey, you did something which I think is very remarkable, is that given the failure of the government, you said, listen, I have some expertise in this area. I know the terrain. I'm going to do something myself. I've been reading about the particular case about you rescuing or being involved in the rescue of this woman named Mariam, who's from Ronnie Jackson's district in Texas. But walk us through a little bit how you did this and what do these private rescue operations look like?
Well, we were called by Congressman Jackson and Congressman Mark Wade Mullen because simply the Department of Defense, Department of State gave them no solution, gave them no answer. And we knew that this mother and her three children, who are Texas natives, by the way, these aren't people who came from Afghanistan. These are born and raised Texas natives who went to visit a grandfather who was ill and who was, you know, towards the end of his life. And so when the Biden administration had made the efforts to close down Bagram Air Base, they had no choice but to take over the domestic terminal, international terminals. That shut down all international flights. That meant that any Emirates flights, any Ariana flights, Cam Air flights, all of those were canceled because they took over this air base, the Americans did. They could have maintained Bagram Air Base this entire time, which has two runways, could have housed tens of thousands of people, had safe standoff distance, which would have provided the, you know, enough security and provisions to have, you know, in my opinion, it would have saved the 13 U.S. service members who died. And you could have still allowed the international flights. They literally destroyed the country's, you know, evacuation program by giving Bagram away and by taking over a civilian airbase. And that's where the trouble started from the beginning.
Now, it sounded like in this particular case involving this family that you mentioned, you couldn't get them out by air for the simple reason that the Biden administration wasn't letting them land. And so you had to sort of get them out by land, get them out across the border, and then fly out only from there. Describe why that was necessary, and second, how it occurred.
So my team and I, we had an approved what they call PPR, which is essentially coordination with the landing tower on when we were slotted to land. We had all the necessary FAA approvals. We'd already designated the aircraft under the FAA as a humanitarian air flight, which means that we could come in and not just fill seats, but actually fill to the weight and balance capacity, which would have been 25 Americans that we were slotted to save. When we were 9,000 feet off the deck and we were actually in landing configuration, we were waved off multiple times by the United States government, at which point we had our PPR denied. We applied three times in the air through our contacts and connections. We were approved. The ground command again, you know, canceled this and tried to prevent us from landing, even scrambled a fighter jet to fly over and buzz the aircraft to try and, you know, thwart us in our efforts. We refused to leave the airspace again. They then threatened to confiscate the aircraft once it lands, take away its aircraft operation certificate, everything, at which point we then had to move to the secondary landing location. It's worth noting, however, Dinesh, that as a result of us having to go to another alternate landing position, a few hours later is when the Abbey Gate explosion went off that killed a couple of Americans, not just on the inside, the 13 brave U.S. service members, but also Americans on the outside, which the Biden administration is not reporting. We had a few people who the State Department had asked to meet there who were blue passport holders who we were in contact with up until the point that we were waved off and the Abbey Gate explosion occurred, and we never heard from them again. So we believe that they had perished.
Now, what you had to do to get this family out, and I'm just using them as a representative of this larger problem, is it sounds like you had to sort of either trick or con some border agents into letting the Americans get out. And so you're forced to do the kind of things that the Biden administration could have made this so much easier, couldn't they? Talk about that difficulty of getting them out. And then second of all, what possible rationale could be provided for the strange behavior of the U.S. government in this case?
Well, there's no rationale that could be explained for the America Last agenda the Biden administration put forward. They left Americans behind. They left SIV members who had supported us and served with us, you know, linguists, interpreters, etc. And yet they claim that it was a great, you know, airlift operation success, but they don't talk to the American people about the fact that 80% of the people they put on the plane have no SIV, have no background check. They're living on military bases right now in America on the taxpayer's dime. And meanwhile, hundreds of Americans are still left behind in Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of SIV applicants and thousands of approved SIV members who are left behind and forgotten by this Biden administration, to include even a guy who saved the Biden, President Biden's life himself. So, you know, it's very interesting that not only did they stop us in that first attempt, Dinesh, but they also had an aircraft that was set up that was going to leave from Mazar-e-Sharif. We had, you know, tens of you know, I want to say it was about 70 plus Americans on this aircraft slotted and vetted to go. And at the last minute, the Taliban had approved the flight. DOD CENTCOM had approved the flight. The State Department had approved the flight. We moved all of our packs all the way over to the airport to try and get to safety. And the State Department claimed that they needed to vet the manifest again. That grounded the flight, canceled the flight. Taliban no longer approved any further flights going out of Mazar-e-Sharif, which then left us with option C, which is to create and actually conduct the very first successful overland rescue of Americans since the fall of Afghanistan.
And then what I find particularly appalling is that once you got them out, there was the Biden administration to say, wow, amazing job that we did. Our embassy staff were there to greet these people, so they don't make it easy on you. But when you do it, they're there to essentially applaud themselves for this. Wow, Corey Mills, very eye-opening. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. Love to have you back sometime.
Thank you. I'd love to come back. Thanks so much, Dinesh.
Merry Christmas, everyone. It's the season of giving, but you know what? You've already given enough to your internet service provider. If you haven't been using ExpressVPN every time you've gone online this year, and I'm not just talking about the enormous internet bill you pay every month, every time you go online without ExpressVPN, your service provider like AT&T, Verizon, can see and log every single website that you visit. And yes, that includes all the sites you visit, even if you're in so-called incognito mode. And this is why I'm kind of done giving to my internet service provider. I go online with ExpressVPN. Now, this app encrypts and reroutes 100% of my network data through their secure servers, so my provider can't see a thing. It couldn't be easier to use. Simply fire up ExpressVPN on your devices, a phone, a laptop, whatever. Tap one button and boom, you're connected. That's it. It's time to take back your internet privacy today with the VPN rated number one by TechRadar and Mashable. Visit expressvpn.com/Dinesh and get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/Dinesh. Go to expressvpn.com/Dinesh. I want to talk about the San Francisco District Attorney, Chesa Boudin. Debbie and I talked about him on the podcast a few days ago. And there is a recall petition that has gathered enough signatures, so there will be a recall election to yank this guy out. But that's not till the middle of next year. In the meantime, the guy continues to do a tremendous amount of damage. And I thought it'd be interesting to look at how these sort of Soros-funded DAs, these left-wing DAs that now are in charge of law enforcement in major cities, major democratic cities, I should add, how they actually operate in particular cases. There's an interesting article in the American Thinker which spells this out. Now, the case we're talking about involves a young woman who is black, originally from Ethiopia, and evidently a drug addict. This is a young woman named Emma Diyo. Now, she was adopted in America by a white family, but she proved sort of unmanageable, and so she was in a kind of drug treatment center, where she was accosted by two MS-13 gang members. There was an altercation. They attacked her. She apparently had a knife, so she pulled out the knife, but they had guns. So you have two big, burly guys with guns. You've got a relatively petite young woman with a knife, and the guns are obviously going to be decisive here. They shot her dead, and then the case came before Chesa Boudin. Now, Chesa Boudin decided no charges need to be filed here.
What?
What is right. So the white family that had adopted Emma Diyo decided, let's go meet with Chesa Boudin. There's a video of the incident, so you can actually see what happened. And so this white family meets with Chesa Boudin. It's a meeting with Chesa Boudin, Christine Soto DeBerry, who is a victim's advocate, and a woman named Diane Knowles, who is a veteran of the DA's office. So you've got the Boudin and his sidekicks on one side, and then you've got the white family on the other talking about their Ethiopian adopted daughter. So Chesa Boudin says, this is a self-defense case. Self-defense case. The MS-13 gang members were defending themselves. Against what? Against this Ethiopian woman who attacked them? No, she didn't attack them. They attacked her. Now, she did pull a knife to defend herself, and they shot her. So where's the self-defense? There is a self-defense from her point of view, had she killed them. But where's the self-defense from their point of view? There is absolutely none. So Boudin says, quote, it's self-defense. Emma had a knife. So apparently for Boudin, the fact that Emma had a knife meant that she was attacking them and they were defending themselves. Now, the family then says, let's watch the video. And the father goes, look at Emma. She's running away. Where's the self-defense? Emma is trying to flee from these guys. And then they shot her. Now, Chesa Boudin says, we never recovered the gun, so we can't charge him. Evidently, what happened is one guy shot her and dropped the gun. The other guy picked it up. And so the cops don't have the gun. But Chesa Boudin is saying, since we don't have the gun, we can't charge him. But the family then goes, well, you keep talking about the knife. You don't have the knife either. And Chesa Boudin says, yeah, we don't have the knife, but, you know, we can see the knife on the video. Well, you can see the gun on the video. So what I'm getting at here is when you see the way in which these guys manipulate and twist facts. And so finally, Chesa Boudin agrees to watch the video again. And they watch it again. And the family is now commenting on it. I want to quote them. Quote, when you read his energy, this is Chesa Boudin's energy, it's like, I'm not doing anything on this. I have to sit here and listen to this victim's family wasting my time. So what they're getting at is tone. They're basically saying that Chesa Boudin, he could care less. To them, he has the mindset in which the victimizer is the true victim. And the victim, in this case, the young Ethiopian woman, is the victimizer. So, you know, most of the people who lose their lives in these situations are people who are sort of on the margins of society. See, this is a woman without political pull, without political capital, probably has less political pull than the gang, MS-13. And with Chesa Boudin, you've got a guy, essentially a hardcore socialist, and I would say communist, a guy who basically developed his radical views through his parents, who were criminals, and also through his radical associations with Chavistas, with Cuban communist Castroites. This is a hardcore guy. This is not some guy who's like deluded by sympathy for criminals because he had a professor at Bowdoin College who told him that criminals are misunderstood people in society. Chesa Boudin is a real bad guy. This is a true savage who doesn't care about human feelings and doesn't care about victims. And it can't be soon enough to give him the boot. He's a very dangerous individual. Particularly one to be put in charge of law enforcement. After taking Balance of Nature, Debbie and I have noticed a real increase in energy. And for Debbie, regularity was a problem. It was solved by this, the fiber and spice. Now, we love taking Balance of Nature because we can't possibly eat the correct servings of fruits and veggies every day. So for us, this makes total sense. In fact, our technical director, Brian, got curious about Balance of Nature. So we said, hey, try it. And he says, well, he's here, so I'm just going to let him pop his head in and tell us. What's been your experience, Brian?
It was really good. I mean, I was just noticing this extra energy and realizing what I wasn't getting in my normal diet. And then after the first bottles ran out, I thought, okay, we'll see how I'm doing. And after a few days, well, I called and I got on the subscription plan because I was realizing how good they are.
Absolutely. Well, Debbie and I can totally... totally ratify that. We take 10 daily servings of the fruits and veggies. They're all in 6 small capsules. Absolutely no trouble swallowing. Always fresh. Nothing artificial. They smell great. So invest in your health. Invest in your life. Experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. It'll last for years to come. Now, for a limited time, all new Preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code AMERICA. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751. Or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code AMERICA. Group of left-wingers from Jake Tapper to Vanity Fair to CNN are accusing Trump of being an anti-Semite. Yes, I kind of kid you not. I mean, let's think about this for a minute. When you're calling someone anti-Semite, you need a little bit of context. In Trump's case, you've got a guy who came of age in New York and in a Jewish environment where he was very, if anything, is pro-Semitic. Here's a guy who's strongly pro-Israel. Remember, Trump is the guy, after lots of people promised to do it, who moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Trump was a guy who was constantly looking out for Israel. He had a very close relationship with Netanyahu, and he seems to be as much of a Zionist as Golda Meir or Netanyahu himself. His son-in-law is Jared Kushner, and his daughter Ivanka converted to Judaism. So if you look at the background, this is on the face of it, a preposterous accusation. But Trump is plain spoken about stuff, and in a recent interview, he made some statements, which apparently Jake Tapper calls, quote, jaw-dropping. So let's look at these jaw-dropping statements. By the way, here's Vanity Fair. Trump goes full anti-Semite, unloads on American Jews in wildly bigoted rant. And here's CNN. Trump uses anti-Semitic tropes. This is Gabby Orr of CNN. She probably just learned the word trope. A trope is basically a term, an anti-Semitic theme. So let's see what these anti-Semitic themes are from Trump. He's speaking to an Israeli journalist named Barak Ravid on a podcast. And he says, first of all, it used to be that Israel had absolute power over Congress. Little bit of an overstatement, but what Trump is getting at, and he's quite right about this, is that Israel used to have bipartisan support. Both parties were strongly pro-Israel. And now the Democrats are increasingly anti-Israel. So the political unanimity that Israel could count on from both parties doesn't exist anymore. So I rate this statement true. True in the sense that I just re-described it. Trump continues. The Jewish people in the U.S. either don't like Israel or don't care about Israel. Now, this is the statement that the left is jumping on. And this is the one that they're calling wildly bigoted. And let's try to understand what they're saying. Here's Vanity Fair. They say Trump went on a lengthy rant about how American Jews supposedly aren't loyal enough to Israel, invoking a longtime anti-Semitic trope. There's that word again, trope, about Jewish people and allegiances to other countries. Okay? But if you really pay attention, Trump, far from ratifying this anti-Semitic trope, is actually saying the exact opposite. So what is the anti-Semitic trope? The anti-Semitic trope is that Jews only care about Israel. They don't care about America. They're too attached to Israel, and they will put Israel's interests ahead of America's. Now, what is Trump saying? Trump is saying the opposite. Trump is saying that American Jews should be more loyal to Israel. They're not loyal enough. They don't care about Israel, evidently. So far from reinforcing anti-Semitism, Trump is undercutting the anti-Semitic trope. He's saying, in a sense, the exact opposite of the kind of ancient accusation that Jews have their allegiances with a foreign country. And finally, Trump says, there are Jewish people that run the New York Times, which he finds amazing because the New York Times is often attacking Israel. Now, this is simply a factually true statement. The New York Times is owned by the Sulzberger family. I mean, it's now public, but the chief interest is owned by the Sulzberger family. And so the idea that the New York Times is, quote, run by Jews is, in fact, nothing more than a statement of fact. So what you have here with this anti-Semitism stuff is it's now become a little bit of a political football. Here's another case. Fox News runs a cartoon by Branko. Branko is a very talented cartoonist, showing George Soros manipulating the defund the police and the no bail movements, which is, again, a factual statement. Soros has poured billions of dollars. Here's the ADL. The ADL goes, as we have told Fox News numerous times, casting a Jewish individual as a puppet master who manipulates national events for malign purposes conjures up long-standing anti-Semitic tropes. Here's that word again, tropes. So the basic idea is that you can't criticize Jews because you are engaging in tropes. Now, think of how stupid this is. We're not criticizing, there's no criticism here. Branko's not criticizing Jews, he's criticizing Soros. And is it an exaggeration to say that Soros views himself as a puppet master, manipulating not just national, but international events? That's how Soros sees himself. That's how Soros describes himself in interviews. He once talked about his messiah complex. So what are these people even saying? Can you not criticize Jeffrey Epstein or Harvey Weinstein? Because, you know what, you're engaging in anti-Semitic tropes. You're implying that Jews are lecherers. You're implying that Jews are financial criminals. You're implying that Jews do this. No, we're not implying that Jews do anything. We're basically focusing on the particular individuals and speaking about them. So it's not that you get a kind of Jewish exemption because to criticize you if you're Jewish somehow invokes a trope. This would be like me saying, well, listen, you know, Indian people are known to be cunning and extremely smart and in some cases diabolical. So anybody who calls me cunning and smart and diabolical, which lots of people, by the way, call me, to my secret delight, I should add, you're invoking anti-Indian tropes, guys. This is racist against brown people. You know, our discourse has totally degenerated. And the latest critiques, both the one from the ADL and the one aimed at Trump, are evidence of this intellectual freefall. It's getting a little late in the game, but you want to get a really cool Christmas present or New Year present for your loved one? Well, how about giving them a new iPhone? That's right. Pure Talk has iPhone 12 starting at just $479 through the end of the year. And yes, they have the 13s too. Now, I switched to Pure Talk and I'm getting great nationwide 5G coverage. Yes, it's the same coverage as the big guys, and you can too. Huge savings. The average family saves over $800 a year. Now, that's just smart. I wouldn't tell you to use a service I'm not completely happy with. Make the switch with Pure Talk's 30-day risk-free guarantee. You have absolutely nothing to lose. Unlimited talk, text, and 6 gigs of data is just 30 $40 a month. And like I said, the iPhone 12, like mine, take a look, just $479. Go to puretalk.com, shop for the plan and phone that's right for you, then enter promo code SAVEHALF. You'll save 50% off your first month, and you'll save on a new phone. That's puretalk.com, promo code SAVEHALF. Pure Talk is simply smarter wireless. Some restrictions apply. See site for details. As we move toward Christmas, I want to talk about some very good news about Christianity on the global front. My message is that Christianity is thriving around the world. And ironically, the atheism, the secularism that was supposed to be the future of the world, is turning out not to be the future at all. Now, these are startling developments, but they're also startling developments that are not obvious to many of us who, so you may say, don't live in the right neighborhood. So here's what I mean. Let's say you live in New York City, or you live in Los Angeles. You go to a local church, and you see, wow, this is a big cathedral, this is a beautiful church, but wow, there's only a dozen people in it. And so you get the idea that in these precincts, these kind of elite urban precincts of New York or California, and by the way, the same could be said in large parts of Europe or in Canada or in Australia, you do have the phenomenon of churches that have become somewhat museumized. If you go see the Cathedral of Chartres or the Cathedral of or go to Canterbury, you now get these tourist guides who take you around. They tell you about the history. They tell you a little bit about the architecture. But what they don't tell you about is the underlying system of beliefs that caused those magnificent structures and destinations to be erected in the first place. So secularization does have something going for it. Elites in the West, primarily in Europe, but also to an extent in America, have become secularized, have also become to some degree anti-Christian, because along with this radical secularism goes a hostility to Christianity, at least Christianity as it expresses itself in the public sphere. And for many of us, that's the story. In fact, that's the story we learned in college. It's not just a story of what's happening, it's a story about what is supposed to happen. In college, in sociology, we learn something that is called the secularization thesis. And the idea here is not just that secularization is happening, but that somehow secularization is a law of history. That secularization is written into, as societies become more sophisticated, more educated, more affluent, they cast aside the primitive religious beliefs that originally defined them, and they all essentially move in the same direction. In a sense, you can say that everybody is headed toward the destination of American or Western secularism. Peter Berger, the sociologist, put it very well. He's describing the secularization thesis, which is that as the inevitable result of science, reason, progress, and modernization, everybody will become more secular. And as he puts it, quote, eventually Iranian mullahs, Pentecostal preachers, and even Tibetan lamas will all think and act like professors of literature at American universities. Now, the good news, which I promised and I'm delivering now, is that this secularization thesis is being disproven empirically around the world. Christianity is growing on pretty much every continent. It's even growing in many parts of the West, but just not in the parts of the West that we often see. So let's talk about some evidence of this. Now, first I should say that we're seeing not just a global revival of Christianity, but a global revival of religion in general. In India, for example, my native country, there's a revival of Hinduism. Now, it has a political form that is sometimes questionable. It's called Hindutva, sort of India is a Hindu country and nobody other than Hindus belongs in India. And I oppose it in that form. But the revival of people having an interest in Hinduism is a remarkable phenomenon. We all know about the revival of Islam. there's a revival of Islam all around the world. And even Islamic countries, think of Iran, think of even Turkey, which were at one time moving in a secular direction, very often, by the way, pushed by a ruling dictator. In Iran, by the Shah, in Turkey, by Ataturk. And that occurred for a while. But then there was, well, I mean, I guess leftists and progressives call it a backlash. But all we mean by a backlash is that essentially the religious sensibilities of Iran and Turkey have asserted themselves. Essentially, even the Turks go, listen, you know, it's one thing to say that we want modernization. It's another whole thing to say that we want to give up Islam. We don't. And so you have a global revival of Islam. Again, it can take ugly forms, but it is a fact nevertheless. It's occurring in Indonesia. It's occurring in pretty much all over the Muslim world. And there's a global revival of Christianity. And this is the biggest revival of all. Christianity, I think it's important to note, is the only truly universal religion. Now, this is not kind of obvious because it seemed, wait a minute, isn't Hinduism universal? No, Hinduism is not universal. Hinduism, by and large, is a religion in India. Now, there are Hindus who are far-flung, who live in Trinidad and who live in the West. And so Hinduism, in that sense, has a little bit of a diaspora. Hindus have been sort of exported, you may say, out of India. But by and large, nobody would claim that Hinduism is universal. Islam is not universal either. Islam is confined to what we now call the Muslim world, but it's by and large the Middle East. It's certain parts, pockets of Asia, places like Indonesia, which by the way is the largest Muslim country in the world, certain parts of North Africa, and Islam has now also penetrated deeper into Africa. But what's the one religion that you can find no matter where you go? What's the one religion that's present in China? It's present in Japan. It's all over Asia. There are Asian countries in which you have massive churches. What's a religion that has not only had its birthplace in Europe, is now in the United States, but is now all over South America? South America, for example, is, of course, it's traditionally Catholic, but we also see a massive movement toward evangelical Christianity in countries like Brazil, which once had virtually no evangelical Christians, was essentially all Catholic. Now you may say, well, wait a minute, unless you're going from Catholic to evangelical Christianity, this is not a net gain, but yes, it is. Why? Because in many cases you have people who were habitual Catholics, who may or may not even go to Mass, who weren't really particularly fervent or enthusiastic about their faith, who are now on fire for Christ, who are now very active in a Pentecostal Christianity, or even inside the Catholic Church, there's a powerful charismatic movement, a revivalist movement. So there's powerful Christianity now in Central and South America. There's Christianity all over Africa. You have African countries, which at one time had virtually no Christians, which are now 30, 40, 50% Christian. And so this is a thrilling story of in which we see this religion that began, in a sense, in Bethlehem, began in a God-forsaken corner of the Roman Empire. Who could have predicted at the time of even Christ's death that this would go anywhere? And even after Constantine converted in the 4th century and Christianity was carried on the backs of the Roman legions, Christianity at that time seemed like, yes, it's going to spread through Europe, but that's it. It's not going to spread really anywhere else. But through a set of remarkable developments, and some of this goes back centuries. It goes back, for example, to the Counter-Reformation, where Catholic missionaries for the first time went to places like Japan. But we have been seeing in the late 20th century and now in the 21st century, huge amounts of conversions, the emergence of indigenous churches all over the world, and a remarkable new phenomenon, which I'll pick up tomorrow and talk perhaps more about it. And that is the emergence of missionaries who are coming from third world countries to the West. Think about this. There are people from Somalia and Mali setting up churches in the Netherlands. You have people, again, brown-skinned and black people coming from other countries setting up churches in America. And these are vibrant, traditional churches. These are not liberal churches where, you know, the miracles, Dinesh, are metaphorical. No, these are churches that believe the world of the Bible. They believe the promises of Jesus. They expect the second coming of the Messiah. These are churches that are ready for the great event that is symbolized this week, namely the birth of a child in the manger who has not only changed Europe, not only changed the world, but it would not be an exaggeration to say has changed everything.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com. Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.